Don't believe what I just saw.
I'm a man. I'm 40.
This is John Sheezer. I'm
Eric Marino.
Eric.
No, I got to tell you about the Clippers. I'm an
addict. Sportsaholics.
Let's just hope this shit doesn't go viral.
Okay.
And when he swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball a solid mile. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball. Satchel Paige is mellow, so is Campanella. Newcomb and Dobie too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Didn't you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Did he hit it? Yes! And that ain't all, he's so whole.
Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone.
All right, it is that time of the week. We are back with Sportsaholics episode number 142, the Jackie Robinson episode. And it's very appropriate because this is a very, very special episode.
It really is, Sheez. I mean, this is a special. Guys, this is unlike any episode I think we've ever done. Basically, what we have is we got to meet the president of the Negro League
Baseball Museum, Bob Kendrick. It's in Kansas City. For those of you listening around the country, if you're ever in Kansas City, I would highly recommend you go down there. It's on 18th and Vine. It's called the Jazz District. It's the Jazz Museum actually shares the same building,
yes,
as the Baseball Museum, and they do a really good job of showing how those two communities actually overlap.
Really great.
And you know, hung out with each other, ball players, musicians, Mr. Bojangles side by side with Satchel Paige and Buck O'Neill. And
yeah, Lena Horne. And I mean, it's amazing. And so the president, Bob, was just nice enough to meet with us and interview. And what we thought was going to be like probably like a 15-minute segment turned into an hour interview while we were standing on what's called the Field of Legends. They have a very cool, they have statues of all the greats. I mean, the Satchel Paige is on the mound. Josh Gibson is a catcher behind the plate, and various greats are around the field. So what you're going to hear is basically us talking for an hour, roughly an hour.
Yeah, instead of quarters, we're going to go marathon.
Right. So this is going to be one long episode.
It's actually great. And guys, before we didn't get too many plugs in while we were actually talking with Bob. So if you go to the MLB, hold on, let me make sure I get the
N.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
is
yeah.
N for Negro.
NL, sorry about that pop there. NLMB.com. NLMB, it's Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. NLBM. God damn, I messed
now,
that up.
Now, the other thing
is NLBM. It's NLBM.com.
We're going to do that on the out. Oh, don't worry. We're going to do that on the outro, too. You're going to hear us again. You're going to hear us all through this. John and I are both there in Kansas City with Bob talking. It's a free-flowing conversation. I can also, just to give a listener heads up, about 35 minutes or so into this interview, you're going to hear somewhat of a ruckus. You're going to hear basically a field trip of kids because it was like junior high or high school.
Yeah,
kids.
They were preteen teens. You know, right at that really annoying stage.
And they came through on a field trip. I mean, this is like the middle of the afternoon, and so all of a sudden it's like we're basically alone. We're alone interviewing Bob by he wanted to take a picture of us near the Satchel Paige statue, which also, when you guys look on our stuff online, you'll see various pictures that we have of the whole trip in Kansas City and etc. But you will hear this. You will hear basically a school field trip run through for a few minutes, and then it's going to leave, and then we're just going to roll with the punches. So I think, with all that said, we'd like to thank Bob for his time.
Yeah.
And this is a great interview.
And he's more or less like the living voice of what Buck O'Neill was, who was in his time featured in Ken Burns' baseball documentary and just full of so many great stories. So we're lucky to actually sit down, or I guess stand up here with Mr. Bob Kendrick from the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and get some of those great stories from his mouth into our mics and into your ears.
So you couldn't do anything better for the Jackie Robinson episode than interview the president of the Negro League Museum, Baseball Museum. And so let's go. Cheese,
yep,
let's go.
We'll do it right here.
The next voice you'll hear is us talking to Bob Kendrick at the museum.
Hit that ball. Did he hit it? Yes. And that ain't
Jack is real gone. Cause Jackie is a real gone guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
A dear friend. He's a dear friend. He brings a group by every year the Sox come to town. Last year, he brought by Mookie Betts and Jackie Bradley
really?
And Stephen Wright. You know, every year, really? Religiously. He's a great friend and a great supporter of the museum and a big fan of the history of Negro Leagues baseball. So, yeah, we love the Sox.
That's great. Well, especially since, you know, the Red Sox were the last people to integrate with Pumpsy Green.
We forgive it. We forgive it. Right. You know, it was really interesting because the Sox had put together these fictitious tryouts and of course, basically said that Jackie and some of the other guys who had come in, they weren't good enough to play, which we know wasn't true.
Right.
And then ultimately, by 1959, they signed Pumpsy Green to kind of complete the cycle of integration in the game of baseball. The very next year, the Negro League ceased operation and goes out of business. Because really, by then, the best young black stars had moved into the major leagues or into the minor league system. No replenishing system for the Negro Leagues. But it's so interesting that when people come here and they learn that it took 12 years before every major league team had at least one black baseball player, they're blown away. Because I think the general consensus is, if Jackie breaks the color barrier in 47, if there was a Negro League, surely it ended in and around that time. Man, it took 12 years.
Now, is that something to be said about the amount of talent that there still was remaining in the Negro Leagues, even after the pros had gotten the best players?
Yeah, because what they got were the best young black stars, or budding stars, I would say, because the superstar Negro Leaguers.
Like Porkchop.
Yeah, exactly. The legendary Henry Aaron. But the superstar Negro Leaguers really were too old. Okay. They had passed their prime. So it's always been my contention that Major League Baseball never got the best black players. The best black players were too old. Yeah, they got good young black players who became stars at the Major League level. Any of this group that we're standing here on the Field of Legends, had they gotten the opportunity, with the exception of Satchel, who, of course, was an old man by the time he got there, and he was still dealing.
Still, yeah.
But you look at these statues, these life-size statues here, any of these guys would have been stars in the major leagues. They'd have been stars in any league, you know, had they been given the opportunity. And I think as baseball fans, we were all cheated. Because we should have seen the best talent taking the field at the same time. And what it leaves you wondering is, how much better would the game of baseball had been had the doors opened sooner? Yeah. And that's the question that we are. And you, I think we can all answer that question, because you can look at what happened to the game after 1947. Well, it's ludicrous to think that these men just started to play great baseball after 1947. They were playing great baseball well before 1947 and well before Jackie Robinson. And so, you know, it just leaves us wondering how much better it would have been, because, you know, Cool Papa Bell was on base all the time. If Ted Williams batting behind Cool Papa Bell, how many more RBIs would Ted Williams have gotten?
Yeah, how does the nickname Cool Papa even happen? I mean, that's a great. I mean,
well, I think it's the greatest nickname in baseball history. Now.
Yeah.
I think indisputable, the greatest nickname in baseball history, and it matched his persona.
Yeah,
Cool was cool, and he was a snazzy dresser. He looked good. He had this, I don't know, almost this racehorse kind of stride,
sure.
You know, that mentality and. You know, but one of the people focus on the base stealing ability. He's one of the greatest base runners this sport has ever seen. Perhaps the greatest base runner this sport has ever seen. Again, because he'd get lost in the speed, and he had the blazing speed, but he knew how to use that speed, and he was a student of the game. Lou Brock, the great Lou Brock, say he met Cool Papa Bell, and when he went to St. Louis after that trade that sent him from Chicago, the Cubs, over to the St. Louis Cardinals.
Over the enemy.
And he gets a call that says Cool Papa Bell wants to talk to him. Now, Lou's a youngster. He knew who Cool Papa Bell was. He's in disbelief that the legendary Cool Papa Bell wants to talk to me. And he says Cool Papa started giving him base running and base stealing tips that he had never heard before. He says, well, Cool Papa Bell, I never saw this in the book. Cool said, it ain't in the book. You
yeah,
know, and that's the thing. And so, you know, sometimes we get so lost in the extraordinary athletic abilities that these men had that you lose sight that they were students of the game. They knew the sport. They knew their craft extraordinarily well. And Cool Papa Bell could read pitches as well as anyone. And then he could take advantage of that tool that he had, that great speed, to do some of the daring things that he did, like score from first base on a bunt. Did it twice against Major League All-Stars. It's the honest to God's truth. Wow. Yeah, twice against Major League All-Stars, once against the great Major Leaguer Chet Lemon in an exhibition game. And so all those daring things that he did, but there was a method to the madness. It wasn't just sheer athleticism. These men knew how to play the game, and they were students of the game.
Now, I wanted to ask you, the last time I was here, and listeners, we're actually standing right in the middle, the around baseball legends here. I don't know, with the curator. What's your official title?
Man, they call me a little bit of everything. Yeah. Now, my title is president, but I don't know if it means anything. But
the Bob Kendrick.
If you could be president, that would be great.
We're here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, on 18th and Vine. And but I've been to the museum several times, and I had a question about the barnstorming and the trips to Japan.
Oh yeah,
were these were those kind of like the seeds that helped the integration, or was that just all money? Money grab?
Well, you know, they were going because it was certainly going to pay. Yeah, there was a wage to be made, but it certainly helped, I think, with this push for integration, and it also, I think, is even deeper than that, because as you mentioned, the barnstorming. The Negro Leaguers were heralded barnstormers, so they took baseball into Canada. They were oftentimes the first Americans to play in many Spanish-speaking countries, and as you alluded, they were really the first to go to take professional baseball to the Japanese, although they never got credit for it. More commonly is Ruth and his All-Stars, who get the recognition.
The 34 tour.
Well, the Philadelphia Royal Giants, a barnstorming team of Negro Leaguers, go to Japan in 1927. 7 years before Ruth and his All-Stars ever make their way to Japan, they play a 24-game exhibition series, go 23-0-1 on the tour. The tour was so successful that several years later, Ruth and his All-Stars would get invited over. And that Philadelphia Royal Giant team was like, they were like U.S. ambassadors. The Japanese absolutely adored them because they treated them with great respect. And, of course, respect is a big part of that culture. Yeah. They didn't go over and try to beat the team as bad as they could. They taught them how to play the game. And so as a result, the Japanese absolutely adored those guys. And so, but as we look at the game today in its global capacity, there are so many ethnicities that make up a Major League roster on any given day. At the heart of it were the Negro Leagues.
You're saying that's how it got to the Dominican Republic. That's how it got.
Okay. That's how it happened. You know, the Negro Leagues helped make this game the global game that it is today. And so in that process, yeah, that helped spawn integration in this game because they were going to other countries. And when they played winter ball in Puerto Rico and Major Leaguers were in Puerto Rico too, there was no separation. They played together. Yeah, and then they came back home and went their own separate ways.
Well, I know we had, and his name escapes me. I know you had the documentary here in the gift shop when I was here last, but it's about the original spring trainings, the first ones down in Arkansas.
Oh, yes.
I forget the gentleman. It's a great documentary.
They showed that. I was down in Hot Springs not too long ago, and they showed that piece down there is a wonderful piece.
And that,
and a lot of the Negro League teams play spring training
in
Hot Springs.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. The Major Leaguers were down in Hot Springs. Negro League teams, particularly the Kansas City Monarchs and the Homestead Grays, were spring training down in Hot Springs as well. And I think there was something to the therapeutic nature of the hot spring water and certainly is rejuvenating capabilities, you know, after going through the grueling parts of training.
So that's how Satchel Paige was able to pitch for so long.
It may have been. He had something, man. I don't know if it was some kind of elixir or what.
Wasn't there a story where his arm was completely gone. By the time he was like 25 or something?
It was gone. It was gone in a little stretch in the 30s, and the Monarchs trainer, Jew Baby Floyd, and as the late great Buck O'Neill would say, I don't know why they call him Jew Baby because he is black as I am, but Jew Baby Floyd was a legendary trainer, and he continued to work on Satchel's arm, and he brought Satchel's arm back to life, and Satchel never had another bout of arm injury after pitching, some will say, into his 70s. Because we don't know how old Satchel really was. The tombstone over in the corner is just hilarious. There's a question mark.
It says birth, question mark, death.
In quotes, by the way. Question mark, in quotes.
And, you know, and I tell the kids, particularly young people when they come here, and I say, you know, it's not far-fetched that he wouldn't know how old he was. Because there were a lot of people who were born, particularly in the Deep South, who did not know how old they were because that birth record was typically kept. Everybody's born at home. And so that birth record was kept in the back page of the family Bible. Well, according to Satchel, the goat ate that page out the Bible. And so
See, and that's what I mean. Satchel Paige is probably my favorite all-time pitcher. And then the story of him just getting his nickname as being a tall, lanky teenager pulling bags. Was it Mobile, Alabama?
Mobile.
He could hold 10 or 12 bags at a time, and so they just looked like he looked like a big satchel.
Satchel was always an entrepreneur. He knew how to make money, and he found a way to make more money than the other kids carrying those bags, and they look like a satchel tree carrying all those bags. And you know, when your nickname is so iconic that people think it's your name, that's pretty special. And you see that quite a bit in the case of the Negro League players. People think that Satchel's name is really Satchel. When you say Leroy Paige, they who are you talking about? You know,
right. Yeah, because I don't know Cool Papa's real name.
No, it's James. Most people don't. Right. They think it's Cool Papa.
It's on the plaque.
Yeah,
you know?
And so when your nickname becomes that iconic, you're pretty special.
That
was certainly the case with the likes of Satchel Paige and Cool Papa Bell. Yeah.
So you were saying right before we started, you were saying about how you were sort of becoming your own as the museum. You're sort of your own worst enemy, because as you popularize the stories, you're raising the value of the collectibles, and these go into private collections. So, like, what are your obstacles? What are your goals moving forward for exhibits or certain things, and what are some of your difficulties?
Well, you know, we got a lot of stories that we still want to tell. You know, I tell aspiring filmmakers all the time when I go out to speak, if you are an aspiring filmmaker, you need to come here, because there are some hidden treasures here that would make some amazing stories.
This looks like a great story.
Exactly.
Yep.
You can't make this stuff up.
No.
And as the late, great Buck O'Neill would say, you know, the truth is better than fiction. So you don't have to fictionalize the story of the Negro Leagues to make it entertaining. So there are so many stories that we still want to tell. We're working on a new exhibit now called Barrier Breakers that will look at the complete integration of the game of baseball from 47 with Jackie Robinson to 59 with Pumpsy Green. Well, all those men went through the same thing. Yeah, you know, none of them had it easy. And so we want to put the spotlight on the other guys. You know, it's so interesting. There were five guys who grew up in 1947.
Well, I was just going to mention Larry Doby, you know, who came up, 2 weeks later?
Five weeks later.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's five guys who grew up in 1947. Everybody knows Jackie. A few more folks know Larry Doby because he breaks the color barrier in the American League with Cleveland. The other three guys are the answers to a trivia question. Yeah, right. Hank Thompson, Willard Brown, and Dan Bankhead. And then Dan Bankhead is the answer to an even better trivia question: who was the first African-American pitcher in Major League Baseball? Most people just naturally assumed that it was Satchel, but it was Dan Bankhead. Satchel goes over in 48.
Right.
Yeah, Dan Bankhead joined Jackie with the Dodgers that same year. Those other guys getting,
Feller and the Indians
the very next year.
Okay.
And Satchel goes 6-1. His rookie season at age 42, which means he likely was closer to 52.
Right.
Yeah, he seen 42 a long time ago, man. And he goes 6-1 with a 2.4 ERA. And quite frankly, he gave up most of those runs that year, his first few outings out of the bullpen. When he got into the starting rotation, the old man was straight up dealing. Yeah, he was still nasty. And he didn't have his great stuff like he did when he was in the Negro Leagues, in the height of his time in the Negro Leagues. But he could still get you out on guts and guile, savvy. And the one thing he never lost was the pinpoint control.
Right.
He could put it exactly where he wanted to. And like I said, even as an old man, he never lost that. Yeah, he was pitching when Charlie Finley brings him back to pitch in 1965 for the Kansas City A's, just before they moved him out to Oakland. And Satchel pitches, he's reportedly 59 at that time, if you believe that he was born in 1906, which I absolutely do not. But anyway, he was supposedly 59 at that time.
Gee, that's incredible.
He pitches three shutout innings against your Boston Red Sox.
Yeah,
giving up only one hit against the Red Sox. Great trivia question. 1965 Boston Red Sox. Who got that lone hit off of Satchel? Hall of Famer, but it's not Ted Williams.
Carl Yastrzemski.
Yes. The only guy to get a hit off of Satchel at age 59, which means he could have been 69 years old. Yaz gets a double against the old man.
Wow.
Satchel leaves him at third, shut down everybody else over three remarkable scoreless innings. Rico Petrocelli was on that team.
Yeah.
And Rico and I were doing a radio interview. He does a little work for the SiriusXM Baseball Network. And so we were doing a radio interview celebrating 50 years of Satchel's amazing feat of accomplishing that. And he says, Bob, we all went to the plate hacking away at that old man. They thought they were going to light this old dude up. And he says, at that time, Page's fastball was still 86, 87 miles an hour, and he's painting the black on it, and they're turning around going back to the dugout in utter disbelief that this old man is still getting them out. And what makes it even funnier, Satchel had faced Yaz's father 2 decades before that.
Now, what is that like, getting to sit down and talk to someone that faced, you know, like some of these legends?
I enjoy it.
Does your mind just open up and immediately?
It does, man. And, you know, it takes you back to, you get to visualize what that was like. You know, I talk to people here in Kansas City now. Everybody swears they were at that ball game that day that Satchel pitched. It was only about 12,000 people there. I must have talked to 20,000 people who swear they were at that game. But you know how that goes, that lore and legend around this stuff. And I was there when it happened. But, you know, I enjoy it quite a bit, you know, which is why I'm so fond of the time that I had with the late, great Buck O'Neill, who helped build this great museum and was his longtime chairman. And the stories that I get to relate to people these days are many of the stories that he shared with me. And I guess in some way it keeps him alive in my mind and in my heart. We miss old Buck. And I don't know if there was a greater storyteller than the late, great Buck O'Neill.
You know, I grew up here in Kansas City. And Buck O'Neill was the face of the city, really, like publicly, and especially after baseball comes out in 92, 93, you know, and he gets, you know, shown into the spotlight for the rest of America to enjoy. But he was at, you know, countless Royals games and just, he was at everywhere, you know, and that's what I love so much about this museum is like, you, like, as we stand here in this field, it, like, these guys are about to start walking and playing catch, you know, and it really gives you a great,
well,
feeling.
I think Ozzie Smith, the great Ozzie Smith, the wizard, who's a dear friend of the museum and a dear friend of mine, when he came here, when we opened the museum in November of 1997, the new museum, and he walked out on his field, and he said it was the most eeriest feeling that he'd ever had, because he understood that he stood on the shoulders of these men to have the opportunity to fulfill his dream of playing in the major leagues, and that was not lost on him. I think that certainly was a great deed of gratitude that he felt as he walked out on this field, and just wanting to thank them for the sacrifice that they made. You know, I go back to something that Buck would say all the time as it related to this museum. You see, it's rare in this country that we celebrate the people who built the bridge. We always celebrate the people who cross over the bridge. But here, we celebrate the bridge builders. These were the men who laid that foundation for the Henry Aarons and the Willie Mayses and those other guys to cross over into the major leagues, for Jackie Robinson to have the opportunity to cross over into the major leagues. But we celebrate those guys who built that foundation alongside those who crossed over that bridge to demonstrate that we all could take the field at the same time and play on a level playing field. And so, you know, it serves us all well to be able to share this story with so many people every year who come here, many of them not knowing what to expect. I think they leave with a greater appreciation for what these men were able to accomplish in the face of adversity, but I think they also leave with an even greater appreciation for just how special this country really is. This story could have only happened in America, even though it's anchored in the ugliness of American segregation. That's not what we focus on. No. Out of segregation came this wonderful story of triumph and conquest. And it's based on one small, simple principle. You won't let me play with you. I'll just create a league of my own. That is the American way.
You know, on the opposite side of that, and I, Cap Anson?
Yeah.
Cap Anson, yes.
He's the evil. You know, I love that you guys highlight that, because you're like, look, the words of one guy, you know, it's just, it's a good lesson. Just say, like, just, you know, you can be influential and it's not always good. Just think about, you know, what you're saying. Unfortunately, you know, in that times it was, you know, a common thought, but it's interesting to kind of like pinpoint, and whether it would have maybe been somebody else,
yeah,
but he was the vocal guy everyone's like, okay,
and we can because get he was so good, he could build that coalition of followers who shared that same sentiment. And this sentiment in this case was, you know, if you
this
allow
is
a black,
1880s,
yeah, right? Yeah, if you allow a black to play with you, you can't play with us. Well, because he was a star. Cap Anson is in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. He was an outstanding baseball player. So it didn't take much to be able to build that sentiment that was shared by others. And so, you know, there's almost this mindset, well, why rock the boat? Why rock the boat? We got a good thing here. There's no need for us to upset this. So, you know, we'll just do our own thing. And again, you know, I think fear had as much to do with why it took so long to integrate our game as anything else. You know, it's easy to say, well, it was the social conditions of our time, and that is so certainly true. But fear played a role in this, too, because when Jackie Robinson came up, guess what? He took somebody's job. Now the other guys are looking over their shoulder wondering, am I next? I don't think the superstar major leaguer was really concerned about integration, but the average major leaguer absolutely was concerned about integration. And, of course, there have always been more average players in whatever field of endeavor it is than there are star players. Stars are set aside for the absolute elite.
Yep.
And so Major League Baseball, Negro League Baseball, they had both had their stars, but they also had that guy who was that average ball player as well. And so all of a sudden, if you allow this influx of great black and Hispanic talent in, I might lose my job. Yeah, and so that had as much to do with this as anything else.
And one of the interesting things, and I think Buck O'Neill is in one of the displays talking about on video, is talking about then once it's – the integration is a great story, but there comes a cost. The entire – all these businesses, all this entrepreneurship, and then there are hotels, there are – you know what I mean? It's like it's great that you no longer – that you can sit at the lunch counter, but also now there are lunch counters that black communities don't own.
Exactly.
And so it's an interesting – there's a loss. I mean, it's an interesting mm-hmm. – you know – it's a very fascinating place, but so how do you, I mean, how does
it is. And that's the bittersweet aspect to the story of the Negro Leagues, and that is that you can directly parallel the rise and fall of the Negro Leagues with the rise and fall of black economy in this country. And to a great extent, black economy never recovered from losing the Negro Leagues. So what was good morally, socially, in terms of the integration of the game of baseball and ultimately leading to the integration of society was devastating economically for black businesses. And as I share with our guest here all the time, there's always a cost for progress, always.
Right.
Today it's more technological in nature, but with each technological advancement, guess what happens? Somebody loses their job. That's the way it is. And it was certainly true in the Negro Leagues because for the exact same reason that you just mentioned, what segregation did was it forced ownership. So even though you were isolated into a small sector here in 18th and Vine, maybe a 10, 12 block radius for black folks to matriculate or assimilate or whatever, you had everything that you needed. So you had black owned hotels, black restaurants, black shops, all these things. And then with integration, those things, for the most part, were lost because those smaller black owned businesses could no longer compete with the larger established businesses. And so we lost a lot during that time, and Buck alludes to that quite a bit. Wherever you had successful black baseball, you had thriving black economies. So there's no question that there was a direct connection, which is why in the museum you see what we call those lifestyle exhibits, the hotel lobby of the street hotel,
the
sleeping room, the barber shop, those things which were so prevalent and prominent during that era of black baseball. The street hotel was the black-owned hotel right down on the corner here at 18th and Vine. And as Buck would say, it wasn't a travesty to have to stay at the street hotel, because if you were black and visited Kansas City, that's where you stayed. But you saw the pictures on the wall over there in that lobby area. You might walk into the sitting room of the street hotel on any given day, and that might be former heavyweight boxing champion Joe Louis sitting in one of those chairs, or the fastest man in the world, Jesse Owens, although Jesse Owens would never race Cool Papa Bell. Flat out refused to race Cool Papa Bell.
Really?
Oh man, Jesse Owens would race horses around the bases, but never Cool Papa Bell. Satchel said, had colleges known about Cool Papa Bell, or if Cool Papa Bell had known about colleges, he'd have made Jesse Owens look like he was standing still. You know, you might have noticed there was a great picture of Lionel Hampton, and Hampton is surrounded by members of the Kansas City Monarchs. Hampton, the great orchestra leader, loved the Monarchs, so much so that old Buck O'Neill would put Hampton in a Monarch uniform. He'd sit on the bench and serve as an honorary coach. Or the picture of Lena Horne, the beautiful Lena Horne, throwing out the first pitch at an All-Star game. Cab Calloway had his own semi-pro black baseball team. So did Louis Armstrong.
Secret Nine.
The Armstrong Secret Nine, based out of New Orleans, as they would say. And as I tell our guests, interestingly enough, all the jazz musicians wanted to be baseball players. all the baseball players wanted to be jazz musicians. But you know what? It hadn't changed. All the athletes want to play music. Yeah. All the music guys want to play whatever these guys are doing. So I think there's always been a mutual admiration for what the others have done. And certainly during that era where they were traveling, then what we now call the old Chitlin' Circuit.
Sure.
So they were mapping out routes that offered accommodations and places for them to eat. And so they became very close-knit. So the jazz stars would go watch these men do their thing by day, and by night they'd go watch the entertainers
makes
do their thing.
In the world. Mm-hmm. See the Monarchs in the day, go see Cab Calloway at night. Now, one of the questions I have, one of the things that fascinates me is like the female player or players that played on the Indianapolis Clowns.
Yes.
So can you tell us more about that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of those, again, pieces that people don't know. There were three women who played professionally in the Negro Leagues: Toni Stone, Mamie Peanut Johnson, and Connie Morgan. Now, Miss Johnson is the only survivor of the three. She's still 81 years young in Washington, D.C. We had her here back in November when we actually unveiled those bronze busts that you see on the pedestals over there, and she was here to join us. Toni Stone was the first female of professional baseball. She took Henry Aaron's spot on the Clowns roster. Right after the Braves had signed Aaron away from the Clowns signed Toni Stone. Toni Stone was a tremendously talented athlete, has a park named for her in St. Paul, Minneapolis, where she grew up. And so people forget that the black women were excluded from that league of their own. And I think if you saw the film, Penny Marshall makes a point by one scene in the film where the ball gets away and this black girl picks it up and fires it in to Gina Davis, and everybody's looking like, oh man, you know. But they were excluded from a league of their own as well, that women, the all-women's league during the war. And so Toni, Mamie, and Connie found an opportunity to play with the Indianapolis Clowns, women who competed with and against the men in the 1950s. And of course, there was also a female owner in Effa Manley, the first woman to be nominated and inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. She and her husband, Abe, owned the Newark Eagles, but it was Mrs. Manley who ran the day-to-day operations of that baseball team. She knew the business of baseball as well as any man, had great talent play for her. Monty Irvin, Larry Doby, Leon Day, Willie Wells, all in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Don Newcomb should be in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. All played for Effa Manley's Newark Eagles. She's the first woman to be nominated and inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. So the Negro Leagues essentially gave women an opportunity to do things in this country before this country gave women an opportunity to do things. Very pioneering league.
Right, and that's even something that still doesn't happen. I mean, we don't intergender sports, really.
No.
All right, and then the other thing, since we're on the Clowns, I finally got one of the greatest things I think you have is the little clip of Goose Tatum playing shadow ball. Like, it's like, because you always hear about, like, in the Ken Burns documentary, they talk about shadow ball. They talk about the Negro Leagues players and the shadow ball, but you don't have footage. You have a little bit of footage of Goose Tatum, and I didn't know the thing about that he then went and started most of the. He went and played for. He's 6'6", so he played for the Harlem Globetrotters, and the Harlem Globetrotters had already existed, but this is how the Harlem Globetrotters became more like the Indianapolis Clowns. They sort of brought, and he was the pioneer of all the classic Globetrotter. Yeah. But so, how do you find something like that?
We're very fortunate. Los Angeles Film House got that footage and cleaned it up and sent it to us, where the people get to enjoy it, and the kids really get a kick out of it, because Goose was so long and gangly.
Oh, the way
and the man had the longest arms I've ever seen on a human being. And if you notice the way he played first base, and let me say this, Goose was a legitimate baseball player. Now, he entertained, but Goose could play. And Goose turned down an opportunity to go to Major League because he didn't want to go through the minor league system, because he was already an established star. He was one of the country's first two-sport professional stars, playing for the Harlem Globetrotters and, of course, playing for the Indianapolis Clowns. And my young Major Leaguers get a kick out of the way he played first base, because most guys play first base using one lead foot. You know, either left or right foot or the lead foot. Goose straddled the bag. And the footwork was absolutely impeccable, the way he hit that bag, man.
It had a little tap on it.
It had a rhythm to it. And those long, long arms. And as I always tease the kids, he had the cap turned kind of to the side, ace deuce, as the kids would say. And I tell them all, I said, it's not new. The hip-hop guys didn't invent that. They were doing that. That video is from 1946. So it's not new.
No,
yeah, but Goose could just walk out on the field and do nothing, and people would erupt into laughter because he was so long and gangly. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget, I was giving a tour to the Big O, Oscar Robertson. We're here for a visit.
Really?
And we were walking through, and we got to that Goose Tatum video, and he didn't know Goose had played baseball. He had played basketball against Goose, had no idea that Goose had been a great baseball player, and Goose was indeed that. You know, Goose is in the Basketball Hall of Fame. You know, Goose was an outstanding basketball player who was a great entertainer, a great showman, but he was a great first baseman for the Indianapolis Clowns.
I mean, the videos, you know, listeners, when you come to Kansas City and you're here at the museum, if you get here soon enough and it's not rotated out. But it's, I mean, we stood there for 5 minutes watching. It was to the point where I'm like, I don't know if this is on loop, but I can't stop watching this.
Yeah, I couldn't either. I love the music you guys chose to put with it. And
the things that he could do with the basketball, he could do with that baseball. It was literally a magician with that base, you know, tucking it in, flipping it through with his leg behind him and
I watched and I couldn't tell when he did or didn't have the ball. Like, you couldn't tell sometimes, is it shadow? Is it in his glove? Did he throw it away? I don't know. Is he faking catching it? I don't know.
They were so good at shadow ball that fans, just as you said, could not actually tell that they didn't have the ball with them. And of course, all the tricks and stuff that they could do, flipping the ball around the back and all this stuff, was just absolutely – and the kids love it. The kids love it. You know, they see that. And I think that's one way in which we certainly grab their attention. And it also gives you an impression of the skill level, the skill set that was part of this thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you have to be really good to be messing around like that and still be a professional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Now, granted, the major leaguers frown on that some, you know, because they say, well, the Negro Leaguers are showboating. They showboating. You know, Buck would tell the story, so a guy would go in the hole, man, and he would dive and flip it behind his back to start the double play. Well, that's a SportsCenter top 10 highlight every day of the week now. Well, the major leaguers would say, well, they're showboating. But as the late, great Buck O'Neill would so eloquently say, it's only showboating when you can't do it. And that was the case.
Yeah. Well, there's another example of just of what the Negro Leagues game brought over.
It was different. It was different. There's no question about it. It was a different game. The pace of the game was different. I think these men embraced that baseball was entertainment. So you're going to see great baseball, but you're going to be thoroughly entertained when you saw these games. And the traditionalists, I guess, in Major League Baseball didn't like that. But the fans.
And that's still a problem with baseball today.
Still a problem.
Bat flips.
Absolutely.
You know, like, but you also see how even when it integrated, it also went more to the National League. So then it was like, so then the National League took on a character that the American League did. And this is before, you know, we're talking about 10 years before, 20 years before the DH. You know, it's like, and so it has, it's like, so there becomes, it's like, you know, it's like all of a sudden this is why we're playing. We play this, you know, I'm an American League guy. We're slow footed and we strike out a lot, you know.
But you're right. The National League was very much more aggressive in signing black players after the integration of the game. And as a result, the National League started dominating those All-Star games. It was just a different pace. Do you talk to guys like Hank Aaron and Willie Mays? They'll say they thought the American League was a place where old ball players went to die. You know, because the game was just different.
That's right, yeah.
You know, it was just different. But they brought over that style of play that was Negro Leagues baseball. And so it was daring and it was aggressive and guys were – but you have to have great athletes to play that way.
Right.
Yeah, you have to have great athletes if you're going to be stealing bases and doing these kinds of things. And so – but these guys understood the showmanship, the entertainment value of what they brought to the game, and fans loved it. It was interesting to see how they had to temper that, though, when they transitioned over to the Major Leagues. Satchel couldn't be Satchel.
Right.
You know, he couldn't do the things that he did in the Negro Leagues once he got over there.
That was the original Branch Rickey decision on Jackie, right?
Absolutely, because Jackie was very – he had the intangibles. Jackie was workmanlike. He was college educated. Those things that I think Rickey thought was necessary for him to easily assimilate to what Major League Baseball culture was.
Was he raised in Pasadena? Was that part
of
it, too?
He grew up in Georgia, but raised in Pasadena.
California.
So he was accustomed to playing with white athletes.
Right.
So that wasn't so foreign to him. But Jackie did bring another style of play that baseball really had not seen when he came over. You know, Jackie's still in bases. Jackie's still in home. You know, guys were still going in the windup, you know, before Jackie got there, and Jackie started stealing home with such regularity, you had to stop here.
Sped up the delivery.
Yeah, you had to go to that stretch. You
so
know,
that's how the stretch. You're saying the stretch really becomes because of the stealing home.
Yeah, absolutely, particularly with guys like Robinson and subsequently the other black players and Hispanic players who came over, it was just, the pace of the game got quicker. It got quicker. Major League Baseball was always good baseball, but it was just different. So a guy got on base, you moved him over to second, and then the big hitters came up and drove him in. And that's fine. Matter of fact, I think the game has shifted back to that again. Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. But our 2014 Royals and 2015 Royals, why were they exciting?
You're right. They were. That was the ball. That was Kane scoring on first on a single.
Scoring from first on a single.
Yep.
Now, that's what you wanted to see. Yeah, it's okay to hit the ball out the ballpark. Sure. That's fine. But, I want to see guys making those great defensive plays and taking that extra base and doing those kinds of things that are really going to hold the fan interest. And I think that's why people fell in love with the Royals, because they were playing a style of baseball they had not seen before. But the baseball they were playing, Negro Leagues baseball.
Stealing base. Like, how many times do you see Dyson go first, second to third? Yeah. Or they'd sub in Gore first, second to third? Yeah. Okay, so listeners, as we're talking, we're right here on the pitcher's mound here at the museum, standing next to Satchel Paige. So it got real loud all of a sudden for about the last 6 minutes of the episode. And that's because there was a field trip that went through. And as we were standing here talking with you, Bob, there were kids running. I mean, I say kids, teenagers running the bases. They were playing shadow ball. Did you pick that up?
And they play shadow ball. And so they don't even know what they're doing. They don't know it's shadow ball, but I love that. And they mimic that, and they're mimicking the poses of the statues.
Kid stood by each statue and doing exactly whatever the statue's doing, the crouch or the arm on the side. It's really fun. It was a funny thing to see.
Yeah, it's great because you're leaving that impression, and I hope they're gaining an understanding and a better sense of what this history is all about. And I tell the young, particularly my young athletes, no sport holds to its history the way baseball does. None. This is the one sport where we consistently compare the stars of the past with the stars of today. I think more or less in the other sports, we just automatically assume that the guys who play in the NBA and the guys who play in the NFL today were better, but not in baseball. But that's the romantic nature of baseball. Whoever your favorite player was when you were a kid, chances are that's going to be your favorite player for the rest of your life.
You know what I'm saying? It's like we've all the Peyton Manning, Tom Brady's played in a different. It's a passing league now, or the hand check in basketball.
Yeah. Yes.
And these change. Like, well, they didn't play. Barkley didn't play the basketball that's being played today.
Exactly. Exactly.
How did you get in? I mean, you're very passionate, clearly, and you're very knowledgeable. So, how did you become the president of the museum?
I have no idea.
Great answer.
I started here as a volunteer in 1993. So it's an amazing story, even as is.
And that was before this museum.
This was before.
Here.
Yeah, okay. We were across the street inside the old Lincoln building, had the first floor space where they're building a new restaurant in that space now. And I started as a volunteer. I was working for the Kansas City Star at that time when I was introduced to the museum for the very first time. So almost from its infancy. But to go from volunteer to now trying to run the place is an amazing story in its own right. But I fell in love with the story. I fell in love with the men and women who made the story. I got to meet Buck for the first time in 1993. And I tell people all the time, once you met Buck, it was all over. You were bitten by the Buck bug. That was it. You wanted to be on Buck's team. You saw the passion. You saw the charisma. You saw this love and the desire to make sure that these men were never forgotten, and that this story would live on. And we knew from the onset that it was literally a race against time. The people who made this history, at some point, were all going to be gone.
Right.
The people who saw them play, at some point, were all going to be gone. But their story certainly deserved greater credence. It deserved to stand the test of time. And so I wanted to be down with the rest of the guys who were involved and wanted to build a museum. At that time, it was really a dream. It was, and this is the first phase of a dream come true to build this current home. We're now expanding our operations into the old Paseo YMCA, the birthplace of the Negro Leagues.
That's where they first signed the
documents.
That's
where they signed
the
documents.
Right?
And that is going to become the Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center.
Oh,
so we've been rehabbing that old historic landmark now for several years. We've gotten the first floor complete, and we're just steadily, phase by phase, working on the rehab of that building, and ultimately that will be the Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center.
Which was a big part of Buck when he was around. It was always
Absolutely.
About the kids.
It was always about the kids, and it was always about education. And this was from a man who was the grandson of a slave, who lived long enough. Well, and matter of fact, he was a part of change, and they lived long enough to enjoy that change.
Right.
But at the forefront of his existence was always education. You know, he was denied an opportunity to go to his native Sarasota High School, but he always understood what the importance of an education was. And like men of that era found ways to educate themselves. You know, Buck had 2 years of college at Edward Waters College. He got his high school diploma from Edward Waters and then ultimately had 2 years of college before the love of baseball and the money lured him away from college.
If I remember correctly from what I've read, he was had every intention, and then when he finally went to his dad, and his dad was like, well, if you're making that much, just go back.
Yeah. You know, now mama wanted him to go to school, but right, daddy right. said, I got a baseball player, he making some money. Yeah, and so, but mama wasn't too happy about that.
That's right.
You know, because
right.
mama wanted to get that education because you knew baseball, you could only play baseball for so long, but Buck was very fortunate and blessed. He made his living in baseball for over 7 decades. And
it was the first black coach, Major League Baseball coach for the Cubs.
1962 with the Chicago Cubs. Of course, he became a groundbreaking scout, and as a scout, signed Hall of Famers Ernie Banks and Lou Brock to their first professional contracts. Hopefully, future Hall of Famers in Joe Carter and Lee Arthur Smith to their first professional contracts. So he had a sensational eye for talent. He was a great manager, great coach. He could have been the first black manager in baseball had he been given the opportunity. When the Cubs had that crazy college of coaches where they rotated guys to become managers, well, when it got to be Buck's turn, they didn't let him on the field. Because if you let him on the field, you probably weren't going to get him off. You know, George Altman, a legendary Negro leaguer, and then had a wonderful career in the major leagues, then goes over to Japan and has a rebirth of a career, still says today that Buck O'Neill was the greatest manager he ever played for. He knew men, he knew the game, but more importantly, he understood those men, and he knew how to get the absolute most out of them. Yeah, and he had great talent play for him, but he also brought out the best of those guys that weren't necessarily the superstar players. And people would always ask him, well, how did you manage Satchel? Well, first of all, nobody managed Satchel. See, you know, Satchel was his own guy now. But as Buck O'Neill would oftentimes say, you know, the art of managing superstars came down to the ideology and understanding that you can't expect a thoroughbred to act like a mule. They just don't. They just don't. And so he understood that, and he was able to get those guys. You're not going to manage them all the same. You know, you're not going to treat them all the same because they're just not. And so,
not that this is a baseball team, but I mean, I can imagine, like, as a head coach, look what he did for you. You came in here as a volunteer.
As a volunteer, man.
And look what he got out of, you know?
Absolutely. I mean,
seemed like you got managed.
Absolutely. And didn't even know it. And didn't even know it. Doggone it. You know, but I tell you what, man, what a blessing for me to have had the opportunity to spend so many years with Buck. And I go back to the summer of 2005 and what ultimately became the fodder for a great book written by Joe Posnanski,
yes,
called The Soul of Baseball, A Road Trip Through Buck O'Neill's America. And I remember the summer of 2005 quite vividly as Buck and Joe and myself were gallivanting all over the country. And we were all lamenting the fact that we were gone from home so much and we were on the road so much that summer that our significant others or our wives weren't going to let us back in the house. And now when I look back after he's gone, it was the greatest summer of my life.
Oh, man.
We spent the summer on the road with Buck O'Neill.
That's great.
And they paid me to do it. Now, they ain't paid me much, but they paid me to do it. You know, and how good was that? And Joe, obviously, the book was a Casey Award-winning book when it was released in 2008. So Buck never got to see the book. Buck passed away in 2006. But it was such a well-written book. But I tell people all the time, you know, you got one of the greatest human beings to ever walk the face of this earth in Buck O'Neill. And Joe, in my opinion, one of the great writers of the 21st century. So it had to be a great book. And as it turned out, it was an outstanding book.
It's a book that you finish and then you immediately want to start back up again because you start thinking of stories and you're like, wait, was that, which story was, and you want to make sure the stories,
right.
You get the stories right. And it's, listeners, definitely go online and find that book. It's incredible.
Yeah. You know, if you're so inclined, we have it in our shop. You can go to NLBM.com.
Yeah, there you go. That's where you go online. Yeah. ML, say it one more time.
NLBM.com, Negro League Baseball Museum.com. and it's available online. It is an easy read. It is an inspirational read. You're going to laugh. You're going to cry. You know, it's a little bit of everything. And Buck O'Neill, who I never saw anyone who was so, I don't know, just people excited him. And he excited them. And we would go places, and even if they didn't know who he was, they were drawn to him. And we would sit in the airport, and people, he would start a conversation because he never met a stranger in his life. And by the time we were going to our respective gates, they're sharing an embrace like they've known each other all their lives. That was Buck O'Neill. He somehow bridged the gap between black and white, men and women, young and old, yeah. Unlike anybody I ever saw in my life.
I was at Chavez Ravine at a Dodgers game last season, and I'm wearing my Royals shirt. And I walk out, and this husband and wife are like, oh, Kansas City, you know, oh, we love Kansas City. We met Buck O'Neill. That was the second thing out of their mouth. We met Buck O'Neill. And then they're like, that guy was so great. And like, and then my mom met him one time at the airport 20 years ago. And, yeah. You know, and every time someone has met, was lucky enough to meet Buck O'Neill, that was now etched in their memory
and
forever.
I think for some folks, it was life-altering to have that opportunity to meet Buck and draw from that inspirational, the wisdom. But that fact that Buck seemed to just love so unassumingly. Didn't matter. He didn't see color. He just saw people, and he just had this universal love for everyone. People would ask me all the time what I remember most about Buck, and for me it was quite simple. You always felt better leaving Buck than you did when you came to see him.
Aren't those good people? Yeah. They're few and far.
They're too far and few. We need a whole lot of Buck O'Neill right now in this country. Yeah. We could use it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's and can you believe we're already right here at this? I just looked down, we're at 46 minutes.
Oh, wow. So you're the whole episode. I still have like two more questions.
We'll do the questions.
All right,
we'll
so turn. I guess it's one is like, what would be a holy grail or something that slipped through your fingers that you would love to have had here?
Oh, man, that's been several things. You know, we've seen these things come up. You know, we know from the get-go, when we see game used, anything, right. Jerseys, bats, those things are going to fetch six figures.
Don't trust
sometimes
it to Eli
better.
Manning. Don't trust that.
Unless Eli Manning is a
You know, recently, Jackie Robinson's Rookie of the Year plaque came up and went, it got, I don't know, several hundred thousand dollars that it generated. And, you know, we wanted it to come home. There have been a couple of other marquee pieces. There was a Rube Foster pocket watch that recently came up. We thought we might have a chance to get it, and we missed out on that. But there are certainly those trinkets that are out there. We have to kind of be very particular, strategic at the things that we go for, because, you know, we know game-worn jersey, as Satchel's game-worn Cleveland Indian jersey several years went for $140,000, you know. So, you know, we knew we didn't have a chance to get those kinds of pieces. But they're in the hands of private collectors, and hopefully we can identify where they are and maybe talk them into at least allowing it to be displayed here.
Right.
It can still remain in their possession, but let the world get to see it.
I mean, it's
the ECL sweater.
That
over in the corner.
That is beautiful.
It is a gorgeous sweater.
The stitching
yes.
on it. Oh, man, yeah. I did a whole 360
And the old shawl collar sweaters are very popular now. The kids love the shawl collar sweaters,
right.
But it goes back to what we're saying now. It ain't new. Yeah. That was 1924 that sweater came from,
right.
And the ECL stands for the Eastern Colored League. So when Rube Foster formed the Negro Leagues, he formed the Negro National League in 1920. A guy named Ed Bolden would form a rival league known as the Eastern Colored League. 1923 and 1924, your very first Negro League World Series, Kansas City Monarchs versus the Hilldale Daisies out of Darby, Pennsylvania. Well, that sweater can be seen in that first World Series picture, the great panoramic looking mm-hmm. photograph that we display there of the two teams on the field for opening day here in Kansas City. The sweater was donated to the museum by former San Diego Padres owner, John Morris.
Wow.
Yeah, old Buck and I talked Mr. Morris into letting us bring that piece home, and he was so generous in allowing us to do so. He has been a tremendous benefactor to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Many of the Kadir Nelson paintings that you saw throughout the museum are pieces that Mr. Morris purchased and then donated to the Negro Leagues Museum. That sweater was in his private collection, but it also gives you an indication of who we're competing against.
Right.
Yeah, John
they
Morris.
They own teams.
Exactly.
Own
and
teams.
You don't just own a team. You don't, right. You don't just own a Major League Baseball team, as we see now, as the bidding continues on the Florida Marlins. And we're talking about into the billions on this thing. So, you know, but the other interesting collection, the Geddy Lee collection.
That's and, the ball collection.
The autograph balls.
And I don't know
just, you know, John said earlier, he was just like, well, I hope someday to have something like this in my house. Well,
and not that, you know. And I don't know if the people in who are listening know who Geddy Lee is. Mm-hmm. Geddy Lee, of course, is the lead singer and bass guitarist for the legendary Hall of Fame rock group Rush. And he's
like, wait, hold on. Hold on. This autograph baseball collection came from the guitar player from Rush?
From Rush.
Who was Canadian. And remember, it was the Negro Leagues that went up to Canada first, so in some ways it's a full circle.
And it's a great story behind the collection because...
He had to have introduced this collection to you. Did he contact you
guys? Well, it's a great story because Rush was playing a concert here several years ago, and Geddy has a good friend that lives here who says, I'm going to take you by to see the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Well, like most people who come here, he fell in love with the museum. You can see him at Blue Jay games all the time. So he fell in love with the museum. Now, unbeknownst to us, he is a huge sports memorabilia collector. He's got some amazing stuff, some Shoeless Joe Jackson stuff, and some other amazing things in his collection.
He has his shoes.
Well, what happened was this collection of single-signed Negro League player autograph baseballs come up in an auction. He decides that he would bid on them with the intent of donating them back to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. He wins the bid. His office calls and says, Geddy has a few baseballs he'd like to donate. Would you all like to have them? Well, naturally we say yes, but we're thinking three or four that he might have picked up somewhere. Turned out to be 200. He has since donated an additional lot of 200, now giving the Negro Leagues Museum one of the largest collection of single-signed Negro League player autographed baseballs anywhere in the world. And as you mentioned, it's all due to the benevolence of one Geddy Lee, a white Canadian rocker. It just goes to show that this story has no boundaries. It has no limit. It touches virtually everyone who experiences it. You've got Hall of Famers in those cases. You got guys who are cup of coffee guys in the Negro Leagues, but they're all important.
It was weird. The first ball we walked up, he goes, oh, that's weird. It's signed on the bridge, and it was the Dandridge ball. You know how he signed it up on the curb so it goes around the horn?
Yeah.
I was like, that's actually one of the best players.
Yeah, and then you got novelty names like that one of the great country western singer, Charlie Pride.
I did see that one. In fact, I just thought it was a coincidence.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't think, they don't know that Charlie Pride played in the Negro Leagues. Charlie Pride was an outstanding pitcher.
Wait, Charlie Pride?
Charlie Pride? The first ball I saw was Charlie Pride.
Kiss an angel good morning, Charlie Pride. Yes.
Okay. We're on the same page now.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't know. And Charlie was a good pitcher in the Negro Leagues who made it into the Yankees organization before he hurt his arm. And after hurting his arm is when he fell back on a pioneering country western music career some 72 million albums sold later. We should all have a fallback career like Charlie Pride.
Man. Wow, yeah. Wow, that's, I mean, it's like, that's, it's also, I gotta tell you guys, we're sitting here, it's like, we have seen the museum and now talking, we're learning about what we just saw. It's blowing our minds on top of blowing our minds. It's crazy. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask is this, like, where do you see, I mean, it's like, since so much of the game is, and we're, so much of the game is about the segregation and then integration of the game, but now we see sort of African-American players in Major League Baseball, it's almost like an all-time low since 1947.
Yeah.
And so your thoughts, where are we going?
Well, I think we're going to see a reversal in that. I think baseball, and I commend Major League Baseball for not only recognizing that that is an issue with the decline of African-Americans playing in the major leagues, but then going out to try and do things to address that issue. You know, right behind the museum, we are collaborating with Major League Baseball, the Players Association, City of Kansas City, State of Missouri, Boys and Girls Club, RBI program, on what it will be baseball's 7th Urban Youth Baseball Academy. But it will be the only one that has a Negro Leagues museum essentially attached to it. Wow. And it'll be right behind the museum.
Oh, that would be incredible.
Should open and start play this fall. A complex that is geared to get urban kids, create an opportunity, take away the economic barrier that sometimes affects the ability to play this game. You know, it's sad to say, but our sport went from a blue-collar sport to a country club sport because sandlots are gone now. You know, and that's sad. That saddens me. I hope I'm wrong, but to me, I think the day of sandlot baseball, it's a thing of the past.
It's hard to find 18 kids with gloves, I mean, and everyone. Yeah.
But you know the thing about it, when I was a kid, we would play, it didn't matter how many kids you had, you just divided them up and you played. And, you know, we learned how to switch hit, you learn how to hit the ball to the opposite field, because if you hit the ball in Miss Jones' yard, you were out. You know, because so you divided it up, and you divided up part of the field, and you made your equipment, and you created that. But our kids are not going to do that anymore. You know, and so now when this game becomes organized the way that it is today, the equipment is ungodly expensive. The league fees, the specialization that goes in it, the training that goes in it. And so it has created a bit of an economic barrier for a lot of urban kids because they just simply can't afford it. So at least with the advent of these urban youth baseball academies, we're taking away that piece. Now we've just got to find kids who have a will and a want to, and they're going to be able to play in one of the best facilities in the country, and then also have the luxury of having a Negro Leagues museum right here in their backyard. So not only will our kids get an opportunity to play the game, they'll get a chance to come here and hopefully see people who look just like them, who played the game as well as anybody ever played the game. But guys not only played the game, they owned teams. They were managers. They were coaches. They were traveling secretaries. They were team physicians. They were fulfilling every aspect of the business of baseball. So we don't want kids only dreaming of playing in the major leagues. I want them to think about all the other possibilities that come along with this great sport.
Well, and I got to say, if you're even at half the games, they're going to be better off with just you on the sideline, you know.
Well,
just...
and they might end up be having a Charlie Pride career or you know what I mean? Like, there's some, the Jazz Museum is next door.
Next door. And
which
some,
is also, and that seems to be part of the synthesis.
And I hope one of them will take my job eventually. Now, let me have it for a few more years.
Yeah, right.
You know, we still got some stuff we want to do, but, you know, but we want them to understand. You know, sometimes I have to pinch myself because I make my living in baseball. And even though it is the history of baseball, it's still baseball. And we're still promoting the great sport of the game of baseball. Negro Leagues baseball, the history of the Negro Leagues is certainly bigger than the game of baseball. It transcends baseball. But it's still just a tiny part of the great story of the game of baseball.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you come into the museum, there's a great short movie that kind of starts you off and... like just everything that you learn
here.
You
stand for the singing of the national anthem.
I'm standing up.
And the young man that's performed the national
anthem. George Wesley Jr.
He did an amazing job.
We were talking about.
He was 15 years old at that time.
Yeah, we were wondering where he is now. So that's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
That's really funny.
But I was just gonna, just like you were saying, like the transcending, you know, just helped better the country, you know, for the lack of a better, you know.
And that's why this story, I think, is so awe-inspiring. It is so compelling because embedded in this story is everything that is good about America. It's everything that America prides itself on because it's about pride. It's about passion. It's about perseverance. It is about that underlying refusal to accept the notion that you're unfit to do anything, so I'll show you. Yeah, I'll show you. And that's really... so. America tried to prevent them from sharing in the joys of her so-called national pastime, but the American spirit allowed them to persevere and prevail. And I think when people come here, and for the more majority of people, I don't care what color you are, for the more majority of people who come here, this is a brand new history. So you come here and you're absolutely amazed by what you're just learning. You're somewhat dismayed by the fact that you just now had an opportunity to learn it because you didn't get to know this when you were in school. And so the kids who are coming here are getting an opportunity to now latch on to this story, hopefully, obviously, for its educational merit, but I think it's a wonderful tool of hope and inspiration.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We've taken up enough of your time on this field of legends.
give us the website, maybe the hours of operation.
Yeah, absolutely. We're open Tuesday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., Sundays noon to 6 p.m. You can find us on the World Wide Web at nlbm.com. And if you're so inclined, you can follow me on Twitter. I don't know what I'm doing on there, but I'm on there.
You do a lot of great stuff. I actually follow you.
I'm at nlbm prez, prez on Twitter. So, and we also have our Facebook page as well. So,
and guys, it's nlbm.com. Visit. They've got all the stuff from the gift shop is available online. There's a bunch of amazing hats, and I'm actually going to go in there and spend some money in about 5 minutes.
So. I'm already thinking of gifts for my brother and my dad. So it's like,
Bob, I'm going to give the handshake here. Thank you so much.
No, man. It's always a pleasure.
And I'm sure we'll be back again.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, sir.
And the education, really. Thank you. Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity. So thanks for being here.
Oh, well, thanks.
What do you mean go get it? Man, that ball's way in left field.
I don't care what field it's in. Willie plays all fields.
Every time we come to the game, you're talking about Willie plays all the fields.
That's right.
Let's call Willie and ask him. Call him.
Okay, hey, Willie.
Yes.
Are you Willie Mays?
Yes.
Whose ball was that?
Why was it?
In left field.
Well, that's Irvin's ball.
I told you that. Every time we come to the game, we got to talk about it. The next time I'm going to sit in the grandstand.
Hey, fellas, what's your name?
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey.
Say who?
Swinging at the plate. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. That giant kid is great. When he hits the ball, it's long gone, man. Hits it farther than camp began. Swings the bat like a little lead pipe. When they reach the ball, it's overripe.
Say Bob, hey, thank you again so much. That was Bob Kendrick, guys, the president, curator, and the man of many, many titles down at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum that is in Kansas City. If you're ever in Kansas City, find your way down to 18th and Vine, the Jazz District as it's kind of labeled, but there's the museum. All those great stories. And Bob's just a very open guy. You know, if you go in there and ask for him, he'll come down and shake your hand with a big smile. And by the way, he'll be dressed exquisitely.
Oh, he was almost dressed in period. I mean, he had the great shoes and the suit. It was like 1947. You know what I mean? Like it's a great vibe. And like, again, the Jazz Museum's right next door. And the two museums, if you will, are also into the stories of jazz and the story of Negro League baseball are very intertwined. And there are so many other things that when you go, I mean, James Earl Jones narrates a piece that's
the opening film. A really good.
You get to see some very rare footage of, as we talked about in the piece, of Goose Tatum, who then went on to the Harlem Globetrotters and playing the shadow ball. There are just so many things, guys. We can't, and they're always changing exhibits.
Yep, they rotate them through. I love the fact that the kids actually were playing the shadow ball while we were talking.
Right.
We were, you know, there's nothing better than being interrupted by kids pretending to play baseball around some of the baseball's greatest players of all time.
And I think it's like, you know, and also the amazing thing that the, you know, the whole RBI, like they're going to have a baseball academy that's going to be
right there. That's going to be really big for the area right there.
And when we left, we were also talking about one of the things that, that Bob was saying, one of the things they're going to do is they're purchasing and renovating, the original building where the original contract or the league
the YMCA building, right, on Paseo, which was that was the original building where Rube Foster who was the commissioner and all the
where they
the sort teams.
Of signed their Declaration, yep, of Independence. They were their first where they there, made the deal and made the group the
let's,
league.
Let's be a league. And I forget, I'm gonna guess that was in the early 20s, or you know, it was
right. Well, go to the museum, right, and find out.
Looks like we should have been paying more attention.
There's so much information, and it was really great. And again, thank you, Bob. Thank you, everybody down there. You know, I'd like to thank Arthur Bryant of the barbecue for a great. That was a great.
We stopped
time.
In there first.
Yeah,
on our way
it's
there.
A real experience, that was, guys.
Yeah, and that's all really right, all within a few blocks of each other. It's incredible. And guys, again, go to NLBM. Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.com. That's NLBM.com. Just, they have tons of stuff that if you want to support financially, I like doing it by purchasing. Every time I go there, I get a new hat or a shirt or
it's a so
video.
Much cool stuff.
And they've got all that stuff is available online. If you want to support or become an annual donate member with the club, I know you can make donations. They send you, in the PBS form, you know,
yes,
little gift
yes.
packs and the DVDs,
the
things
bags,
like,
yeah,
right,
whatever,
you know, free
yeah,
admissions.
Sure.
And, but guys, I can't really, I mean, you just heard that it's incredible. And for those of you that really are into not only sports history, but American history, it's a one-stop shop for her.
Hey, you know, just to sort of the one thing that, because this was done earlier in the week and then we had a whole, and the next episode, guys, our next episode, we're going to talk a lot about the whole Kansas City trip.
Yeah, we'll recap
all those stories,
the comedy.
But
and everything.
I will say, just the one thing that really stuck out to me was, you know, John Schieser here. I'm sorry, I got used to calling him John. I was around his parents. We went to Kauffman Stadium. I went to my first Royals game at Kauffman Stadium, and we went there early. There was a rain delay too, so we got to walk through the Royals Hall of Fame, which was also very neat, and in some ways, like sort of an interesting counterpoint. The Negro League Museum. And also, it was one of the great things was right at the end, right as you're leaving, there was a huge bronze bust of Buck O'Neill.
Oh, that's right. I just had to get my picture taken.
And you'll
with
see
it.
That picture on the
thing. We'll throw it up. And which that was really impressive. I was happy with the Royals. They finally did something really. I'd never been through there in the years that it had been open, but they had a really nice Giordano Ventura tribute. They got into the Royals' history as far as their farm program, stuff we'd all talked about with Art Stewart on previous episodes. But they set up their baseball academies.
Right.
I know the image of the Midwest region and where the radio networks were.
Yes, it was as an East Coast, West Coast guy, it was like, I mean, I know a map and I know where Missouri and Kansas and Oklahoma and Nebraska and Iowa are, but it was like seeing this footprint, like, here's the Royals radio network. And it was like in Iowa and Oklahoma
Western
and Arkansas.
Nebraska.
Right. And I was like, oh, this is all...
It's not just Boston where you're like, bam, 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 bam. You know what I mean?
I mean, I knew that I was on the border because we kept going between Kansas and Missouri, and I never kind of knew what state I'd be in next. But I still didn't know. I actually didn't know where on the border I was, if that makes north or south. I actually thought we were much southerner than we were. Anyway, again, Bob and everybody at the museum, thank you for a wonderful day and all the time. You guys were super courteous and so informational and helpful. And God, I can't wait to talk to you again, Bob. So thanks.
And guys, listeners, again, that's NLBM.com. That's for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, NLBM.com. Just go on there, you know, just they've got a ton of great stuff to order.
I've got to get an Indianapolis Clown shirt because they just didn't have my size that day. And I figure, well, if I go online, they're going to have it.
Goose just jumped into my top five, I think, players of all time.
Goose Tatum? I've got to find more. I mean, that was – and remember, that was one of the things that Bob said very early in the interview. Was like, if you're a filmmaker, there are so many untold stories, you know? And
Or the white umpire that would jump and he's all, like, crazy and – you had not seen that picture before.
I think I had, because I think it's something you'd seen like in the Ken Burns documentary. Yes, exactly. But I was actually looking at like, that guy was white?
Yeah. I thought that was like the special day. It's like he had this like crazy outgoing white dude who was jumping around. You know what? And that could have just been an old picture. He might not have been white. I just assumed that he was. He had a very... Well, you know what? We'll have to call Bob.
We'll go back to Bob.
Bob, thank you so much for your time. Listeners, thank you so much for your ears this episode. And support the Baseball Museum. Support baseball history. And, go to the website and do what you can.
All right. That's our show. Stay obsessed, everybody. We'll see you in the next episode.
Anything his way is out. Man, it just don't pay those guys to clout. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey.
Say who?
Swinging at the plate. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. That giant kid. Served his Uncle Sam. He left the Giants in an awful jam. But now he's back and he's Leo's joy. And Willie's still a growing boy. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey.
Say who?
Swinging at the plate. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. That Giants kid is great. That Giants kid is great. Say Willie. What you gonna say?